Shootings in Two Dimensions, The Risks of Building, and The Budget Cometh. I'm Justin Katz, and this is Last Impressions 20. Build Me Up Buttercup, The Foundations. That's a quick rendition. I might have staggered on a note or two there, but I don't know if I can claim that this is anything unusual, but I'm a little discombobulated today. We're in a transition between school year and summer, and I'm not quite settled. So at the very least, I'm out of my secure, usually pretty quiet location where the only person who can make a noise in the background is me. And so things may go a little awry here, but We're going to get it done because it's Thursday, and this is what I do on Thursdays. So, we had the shooting at a baseball field, specifically a shooting of Republicans from Congress. I have to say the Democrats' reaction and reaction of the mainstream media and progressives, it's disappointing. I mean, adjust for social media world and any nut with a Facebook or Twitter account can catch your attention with some ridiculous thing they're saying. But, you know, just the idea that this isn't political has been passed around a bit. And it's explicitly political. I had a post on the Ocean State Current where, you know, my main concern here is some of the things that this guy, the shooter, has written and said about Donald Trump and about Republicans is almost verbatim things that many prominent Democrats have said, including our own Congressman David Cicilline and our own Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. I mean, Whitehouse, for example, said the president pulling out of the Paris Agreement was betraying the country. This guy called President Trump a traitor. There's a connection here. Now, it's not causal. The politicians aren't to blame for this nut job, but it's, you do have to take an assessment, you know, and this is how the First Amendment ought to work. You know, we get to say things with a wide latitude until we cross a line that is specifically your language becomes conduct or action where, you know, you're shouting fire in a theater and people don't have time to process the information and look around. So they run, it causes causes a stampede and somebody gets hurt. That's speech as action. But in general, what we have to do is when some people are using rhetoric that creates this environment in which something happens, it's not their fault. We don't have to restrict speech. We don't have to put them in jail, but we have to speak up and say, you know what? Your speech has fostered this environment. That's healthy. And I'm not seeing it. And I'm not seeing journalists challenging Cicilline and Whitehouse saying, hey, are you going to tone down the things you've been saying now? It's too late. Thousands of people are going to die from repeal of Obamacare. The environment is going to, we're all going to die because of, if we don't get a control of the environment, we've got to do it. It's almost too late. We've got to take action. We've got to stop this legislation by any means necessary. And this stuff all contributes to this environment. And we need to rein it in. Now, yeah, there are crazies on both sides. There are all kinds of abuses and spin and lies on both sides, you know, but I gotta say, I'm not seeing that equivalence as much recently. Equivalence partisan, but more a left and right. I'm not seeing, you know, you hear about, President Trump, he encouraged violence at his rallies. Well, you know, there were a couple incidents of people pushing and shoving and maybe a punch or two, not directly attributable to him, you know, I don't think. But then you've got rioting in the streets. I mean, you've got people specifically talking about assassinating the president and killing Republicans. You've even got the marchers, in Providence over the immigration issue, went to, Representative Culkin's house, was it? And with signs like, we put you there and we will take you out. I mean, that's where we need to, the left is getting a little out of sorts here, I think. And, you know, I continue to be astonished by the two. We're really in two different dimensions, two different worlds. Now there's the shooting, and you know, Republicans, conservatives said, "Well, you know, you're clearly this was political, and this is your speech." And the New York Times is, as far as I can tell, is blaming Republicans. Others, you know, it's all to do with Republican language and Republican. It's, or it's not political at all. It's just a crazy guy. And we've, and this kiss comes right on the heels of all these hearings we've seen about, you know, former FBI Director Comey and Attorney General Jeff Sessions, where, you know, we have these day long hearings, and then you look at the news media coverage, and on the left, it's Trump targeted, exposed, Trump whatever, you know. And on the right, it's, well, that fizzled, didn't it? There was nothing here. What are we, another wasted session of with no information because there's no controversy. It's just people are looking at the same thing and coming and describing it in exactly opposing ways. I mean, it really is like two worlds. I don't know how we get back to, I guess, except for the exchange of free speech and correcting each other when we err, or trying to, or offering our suggestions, which may be errors in their own right. But, you know, I think from my perspective, one side is objectively more correct than the other. So I'm up for, you know, the free exchange of ideas, because I think my side's correct. What else? Recently, Alan Rosenberg, who's, I guess, the new executive editor for the Providence Journal, has been making his presence known in the state. He published an essay, op-ed, or however it was presented, talking about two readers who had contacted him asking them to cancel their subscriptions because of the bias in a newspaper. And he said, "Oh, we're not biased. We're journalists, and we have to, you know, they're biased. Are you serious?" I mean, he was on, he did an interview with Ian Donis on Rhode Island Public Radio, and Ian put or whoever put up Ian's essay and recording, put up a picture of the current day Providence Journal, and it was Jeff Sessions after his hearing. During his hearing, and the photo they used was this. Sessions has this kind of crazed look on his face, and he's got his fist up like he's about to pound the table. And then you contrast that with, say, the Wall Street Journal's photo for the same story, and it's, you know, it's a very similar photo, but if you put them up side by side, you see, I mean, Sessions has, you know, passion and intent. A level of intensity, but it's not crazed. The cast of the eyes is just enough different, and his hand isn't enough fist. It's in, you know, more like a karate chop. Like he's making an emphatic point, but he's not about to pound on the table and make the pencils all bounce or anything like that. And I mean, that's bias. Today, above the fold, bold letters. You'd think we had just gone to World War III. It says Trump, part of probe. So, you know, the big revelation that they're investigating whether the president obstructed justice. But, you know, it's there with the narrative they're really creating. I mean, objectively, okay, he's part of that. The special investigator is looking into it. But what you get with this giant headline, Trump, part of probe, is the idea that this is the next step. And I wrote about this recently where you know, speaking of Senator Whitehouse and rhetoric, where Whitehouse did a town hall kind of thing in Providence, and one of the people got up and in the audience got up and said, "Well, when can we expect impeachment?" And Whitehouse didn't, you know, there was no cautionary tone to the effect of, "Well, you know, we're a long, long way from that, folks. There's still plenty chance that we'll discover our president isn't a traitor, and, you know, we're still waiting for the information to come in. Let's not jump to any conclusions." None of that. It's like, "Well, here are the steps. Here's what we'll see. And that's when we'll know we're getting close to impeaching him." It's, you know, it's like that. This Trump part of probe, this bold thing. It's a declaration. We're at the next step. You know, we've got the investigation going. Now we know he's part of the probe. Next, we'll find out that he was involved in something or other. And then we'll get to the impeachment. And then we'll knock him out of office and have a revolution. Oh, great. But So you've got that on the front page of the Providence Journal, Trump part of probe. And then that's over a story. I'm looking on a print edition, on a digital edition, so I don't know if it's under or above the fold. But under that is a story about the shooting, and it doesn't say anything about targeting Republicans in the title. And then the first sentence is that the shooter was angry with President Donald Trump. So see, it's his fault. He's part of the probe. And the shooter was angry about him and took it out on some Republicans. You get to page 11 and it's, you know, there's another headline. Gunman had a long history of anti-GOP activity. So wouldn't that seem to be, I mean, let's be honest here. If this were reversed, and it's during the Obama years or something, the headline, it would have been above the fold and even bigger letters, no doubt, probably the full front page. And the headline would have been anti-Democrat activist shoots congressman or something like that. This is bias, and in not only perpetuating it as an ostensibly objective source of journalism, but in denying its existence, the Providence Journal is making it impossible for us to bring these multiple dimensions together and come to a sort of mutual understanding of what's going on today. And speaking of the word mutual, I've been harping on a sense I'm getting lately, and I don't know if I'm just sensitive to it or if it's increased or what, but it seems like the legislators at the Rhode Island State House have been, you'll see things like, oh, we're coming to mutually agreeable terms and we're negotiating, and they're talking about legislation that's going to force Rhode Islanders to do things, and those, you know, the Rhode Islanders, most of the Rhode Islanders who are going to have to do things are not in on the negotiations. it's special interests who are in on the negotiations. A few limited groups, like we're going to assume that the Northern Rhode Island Chamber of Commerce speaks for every business in the state and is authorized to negotiate on their behalf. That's just not the way it ought to be seen. And then you know, in the same kind of stories, you talk here about how nobody else showed up for the hearings. It was just these groups. And, you know, if they were really stepping outside the bounds of what's appropriate, well, then people would have been there and would have lined the halls and pounded the tables with the Jeff Sessions fist. And think of the burden that puts on. And now, we all know, come on, let's be honest. We all know that apathy reigns around here. And we all know that even when apathy doesn't reign, you don't get waves of people for, you know, these kinds of regulations. Can you imagine the cost, the additional cost on businesses, not only of maybe paying lobbyists, but of time and effort to try to trace and track every bit of legislation that might have some negative effect on your business, and then go or hire somebody to go and speak out against it? I mean, is that how representative democracy is supposed to work, where we all have to constantly be every day at the State House, vigilant, waiting for 4 to 6 hours to testify on bills that some legislator thinks is a good idea, some 20-something kid out of college who happened to get a legislative seat because folks in Providence are nuts, every business in the state, every non-progressive in the state has to be constantly on guard that the government is going to do something to them. I mean, is that representative democracy? I don't think it is. So that's the rant for today. I've been building I mentioned I'm in a transitionary period. Excuse me, I'm being casual today. It's June. And I've been working, you know, in the yard. I've building a shed to get stuff out of the garage, so maybe we could do something radical, like put a car in there. It reminded me of something I had read from Herman Melville, the novelist of Moby Dick, who wrote Moby Dick, and it actually comes from a letter of his to Nathaniel Hawthorne, who wrote Scarlet Letter, among other things. It was a letter from dated June 29, 1851. This is the passage that came to mind. Since you have been here, I have been building some shanties of houses connected with the old one, and likewise some shanties of chapters and essays. I have been ploughing and sowing and raising and painting and printing and praying, and now begin to come out upon a less bustling time, and to enjoy the calm prospect of things from a fair piazza at the north of the old farmhouse here. So that always struck me. It's like the, if you've seen the HBO special limited series, John Adams, there's one scene after he's been, you know, after the revolution and after he's been president and traveled foreign countries as an ambassador, Adams is on his house, you know, fixing his own roof, hammer and nails and shingles in his hand. I love that image because I think there's a lot we lose when we lose track of this sort of thing. I mean, before the Rhode Island economy sort of fortuitously forced me into construction to make some money because there wasn't much else to do around here for work. I couldn't even hammer a nail. I used to actually believe if you see a movie where you say that the bathtub falls through the floor, you know, and it looks like the floor is essentially just for all we know, a piece of plywood with some flooring on the top and some sheetrock on the bottom or something like that. When I actually didn't know what was in a wall, I had no idea. And it's so limiting to not know. I mean, obviously we can't know everything about everything, but to not have any sense at all of something as basic as construction and or any real experience with something as critical and fundamental as building a structure, there's so much you don't learn. It's, you know, building the shed out here, it's been a reminder of what a sort of a different job it is. On the one hand, I mean, it's really nice, I have to say. Now that I don't have to do it every day, all day, construction is really fun. And you get this sense of accomplishment, this sense of you've built something. At the end of the day, however far you've gotten, you can step back and say, oh, look at those rafters. And often you go, oops, that one's got to come out, I cut it wrong. But it's nice to have that kind of daily affirmation. There's no subjectivity about that part of it. You've built something. In Melville's phrase, he's building some shanties of chapters and essays. So, you know, you can step back and say, okay, I'm done with one chapter or one essay. But it's, you know, it's somewhat different. Graphic design, I guess, is more similar, where you can look at the essay or the website or the produced thing and say, and admire it. A bunch of words on a page, it all looks kind of the same unless you take the time to read it. You know, there's not that one perspective. Although, you know, for literary nerds, there's Queequeg in the Moby Dick, who is just amazed at the beginning of the novel. He comes across a book in a hotel, I believe, and he's just amazed at the amount of letters that are written in this book. It's just astonishing. You can't believe it. What an accomplishment to put so many squiggles in a book. So I guess there's that. But if you know the important thing is what the words say, then you kind of have to read it all. So you don't get to, you can't step back at the end of the day. And especially if you're a careful writer and say, look at this big stack of paper. And especially if you're writing, you know, nowadays on a computer. But so it's useful when it's done. Also, when you're building, you get back. It's not just, you know, a novel that, or an essay or something that you're going to put out there and people will read or not. I mean, I'll have a shed and I'll be able to empty it out with the garage and it'll be there and it'll be useful. You can look at it. You can put stuff in it. You can lock it and open it. The kids can hide in it. Hopefully there's nothing dangerous in there when they do. But it's a very different thing. But on the other hand, I started with lessons of building, and I'm reminded of there's a certain stress to it too that I don't find with other things, and maybe we should feel more often. I mean, everything I'm doing, it's been a little while since I've built anything, you know, I've repaired stuff and installed a door and a window here, you know, but that I haven't built anything substantial in a while, and I had forgotten, I guess, how kind of stressed out I get over these things. Did I do that right? Is this going to take the weight load? What happens if there's a major storm? Is this thing going to blow over? Do I need to put something here to anchor that to this? And what if somebody's in this and this creaks or the water gets in here and rots this out and it falls? And you know, and this will always used to cause me all kinds of anguish as a foreman. I mean, obviously you have other carpenters and engineers and architects and inspectors on a professional building job. So there's that, and your boss has ultimate responsibility, you know, but it used to agonize me sometimes to just, am I doing this correctly? Because if I don't, somebody could get hurt. So a kid could get sick, or something could, you know, if we get water and there's mold and there's a kid, who knows? There may not even be, the client may not even have a kid, but someday there may be a kid here and it'll be mold and it'll be my fault. And there's a sort of a stress to that. And I think we should be even more respectful of this, these risks and these dangers in public policy. I mean, if you, you know, in history, you know, bad government decisions have caused famines, entire civilizations hobbled. You could look superficially, somewhat more superficially, I guess, across the border in Connecticut, where they've gone, oops, we raised taxes on the rich and now they're leaving and our economy's falling apart and our tax revenue is coming up short. Maybe that was a bad idea. Of course, you also have across the other border, Massachusetts now trying to chart the same course of a surcharge on wealthy people, defined as anybody with income over $1 million. So that's another, you know, they make these decisions and I wonder, are they stressed? Are they worried? Well, what if this goes wrong? Are in the future, will they say, yes, that was an error. We have to take this back. I don't know. I mean, I think this is necessarily something that has a mirror image across the ideological divide, because, you know, it's one thing to construct something and say, you're going to use this political structure. You're going to use where this policy is going to take from you and give to you or do this thing or make you do this thing. It's one thing to do that. It's another to say, you know what, we're going to ease up on this. You know, if you take down a building, you can say, well, that'd be useful to have again. And I guess in a big picture, you could worry that there was some disaster. There was no shelter, but it's quite a different thing, because you're taking the structure apart. You're easing it up. Is different than piling on, because, you know, piling on, and you get a collapse. You get people trapped in the thing that you had built. Whereas if you take it down, there's an opportunity of freedom. I'm way too deep in this metaphor right now. So let me point out the final example I was going to give was Venezuela, where, you know, do all those people who praise Chavez and the move towards socialism, are all of them saying, wow, I backed that. That was a big, big mistake. And to the small degree that I contributed to the environment that allowed that to happen, I'm now responsible for all of that suffering and probably the much more suffering to come. Do people think that way about politics and government policy? I suspect they don't, and they should. It should be a constant concern of theirs. I mean, come to think of it, even if you, something like the UHIP debacle, I mean, that would keep me up at night. I wouldn't be able to sleep knowing that I was causing all my errors in judgment as the governor, for example, were causing all these problems. Or even, you know, the DMV thing we're about to go through. If this is a mess and thousands of people's lives are just distracted and they're spending hours and hours online, I would feel responsible for that if I were in government. It's just, do the people who run for office and take office and run things, do they have that level of concern and anxiety? I'd like to think they do, but I kind of wonder if people who would just, if that's another area where having such a big, expansive government is not healthy, because a lot of people just won't run for office exactly for the reason that they know they would feel guilty or bad, and they don't have a response. They don't feel like they've got all the answers, and so they just stay out of it because they'll have to make these decisions in this big government we've got. You know, it's funny. A while back, somebody locally was asking me. I forget if it was in my capacity as a budget committee member or just as a local agitator, and budget cutter and money stealer, but. The person asked me on Facebook, well, what's your vision for the town? And I essentially wrote back, my vision is a town where we all use our property in the ways we see fit with some framework of government to help us resolve our issues and conflicts among each other so that we don't have neighbors, you know, shooting at each other over a fence, that kind of thing, to give a forum for that, to make sure that somebody building a mall doesn't just plop it down this high rise leaning over somebody's home that they built over years. And there's some way to resolve these problems without, you know, violence and terrorism and such. And to this day, I'll see this person mention that, that I failed to offer a vision, you know, as if I'm hiding my vision. I really want Pottersville, right? That's my vision, is it's a place where I'm not making all of your decisions, you know, or where we're not forcing people to do things. Why isn't that a vision? You know, I think it is. I think that's a reasonable strategy. And if we followed that, then we would get more people with better ideas working for the public good, because the weight wouldn't so much be on them. You know, their errors wouldn't be theirs alone. They're not claiming to be able to run our lives. I wonder if our current political system selects for people who think they can run our lives and who feel at least a somewhat suppressed or subdued remorse and anxiety over the fact that they are hurting other people. That's just sort of my perspective. So, and I wonder too, with the budget that's supposedly coming out today, in the General Assembly. So by the time most of you hear this, the General Assembly's budget will have been unveiled, and if not possibly digested yet, at least out there, and we'll have some sense of what's in it, at least a headline sense. You know, this revelation of the General Assembly's budget, it's an event for which people in Rhode Island policy and government and media, we wait with kind of dread and anticipation. And most of the people in the state don't even know about it. A budget? Oh, I guess so. When's it come out? What's it do? Who? What are we paying for? And that's not healthy either. But imagine if it were smaller, you know, and we didn't all have to have anxiety about it, and it didn't change our lives so to this degree because government wasn't in charge of everything. So, I mean, a rundown. I just looked up the numbers real quick a little while ago. The governor's proposal was for a $9.2 billion budget. $9.2 billion, which was a 0.5% increase over the revised budget. And this is the key part. The revised budget is up about 3% from what was enacted. What this means, and then last year's budget, they put aside too much money. They took too much money, more than they needed to spend. So they revised that down. So if you look at what they want for the revised budget of this year, and add it to the was actually spent last year, it's an 8% increase in 1 year. 8%. That's just amazing to me. Inflation, by the way, over the last year was around 1.9%. So we've got a stagnant population, a stagnant economy. The employment numbers are up for now, but every year they're up around this time of year, and then they're revised down every single year. So we can expect it to happen again. And yet an 8% increase in the spending of the state government. Is there this sense of remorse and anxiety that they're taking money away from people that could be used for other things, that they're forcing people out of the state with this spending, this constant spending, and these budgets that just go on and sneak in an 8% increase by breaking it up 1 year when they enact the budget and the next year when they revise it upward? I don't know. Yeah. Maybe a little build me up butter couple. Put some perspective on it.